Venture inside Tibetan-styled stone structure at the foot of the towering Mount Everest and make your way past the booking office of Himalayan Escapes, Tours, and Expeditions. This is a lot.
You're listening to Attraction Obsession, the podcast that takes an in-depth look at some of the most famous theme park attractions from all over the country. Backstories, histories, and behind-the-scenes secrets of some of your favorite rides. Now here is your host of Attraction Obsession, Matt.
Hello and welcome to Attraction Obsession. This is episode 2. My name is Matt from NeoZazz.com, and in this episode, I'll be taking an in-depth look at Expedition Everest, the Legend of Forbidden Mountain at Walt Disney World's Animal Kingdom. To start things off with each episode, we pose the simple question, what is Expedition Everest, the Legend of Forbidden Mountain? And again, we turn to the internet and check out Animal Kingdom's current attraction pitch, which reads, venture inside a Tibetan-style stone structure at the foot of the towering Mount Everest and make your way past the booking office of Himalayan Escapes, Tours, and Expeditions. Wander past a small temple and a cozy general store before exploring a museum dedicated to the study of the Yeti, the mysterious snow monster said to inhabit the Himalayas. The adventure begins. Board a weather-beaten train and ascend a series of rolling hills overlooking the serene green forest. Climb a steep incline and navigate through a ceremonial stone tunnel before reaching the summit. Once at the top of the world, hold on tight as you pick up speed and race inside the dreaded mountain. An unexpected encounter. Without warning, your train screeches to a halt. A broken and twisted track appears in front of you. Brace yourself as your train unpredictably begins to race backwards through a darkened mountain, furiously swooping up into a double looping turn. Inside the windswept passage, a shadowy figure of a growling creature can be seen on the cave wall. It's the Yeti. The legend is real. Hurl 80 feet down the base of the cursed mountain and swoop in and out of murky caves along jagged rocky ledges as you race to escape the dreaded monster before he catches up with you. Will you make it back to civilization safely, or will the Yeti claim another victim? Wow. Okay. So that is that description almost takes care of my entire walkthrough, which I've actually already recorded, so I'll still insert it. But that is a pretty thorough description. As I started off saying in this episode, it's found at Walt Disney World's Animal Kingdom. It was officially announced as an attraction coming on April 22nd, 2003. This was also Animal Kingdom's 5th anniversary. The announcement was part of their 5th anniversary ceremony that took place that day. The actual grand opening of the ride was just under 3 years later, having opened on April 7th of 2006. This entire attraction was part of an expansion project for Animal Kingdom. They added an additional 6.2 acres of land to the park, and the mountain range for this ride alone covered one entire acre of this new expansion just by itself. The rest of the area is used to help tell the story, because this ride wasn't built just as a thrill ride. It was built to tell a story from the second you stepped into this new land till the time you got off the ride. So to learn more of that story, now we'll do the virtual tour. And at this point, I'm going to give the last spoiler warning. If you haven't been on this ride and don't want to know anything about it, or if you don't want to know anything about how this ride works or how it was built, this is the point to turn off this episode or to stop listening, because the rest of this episode is going to cover the entire experience and how everything works on Expedition Everest. Okay, here we go. Walking through the Asia area of Walt Disney World's Animal Kingdom, we come across an old village at the foothills of the Himalayas. It's the village of Sirka Zong, part of the kingdom of Annadhapur. The weather buildings made of rammed earth bricks once served as the operations for the Royal Annadhapur Tea Company, but now have been repurposed by the entrepreneurial team of Norbu and Bob and serve as the Himalayan Escapes Tour Company. Himalayan Escapes features their Expedition Everest excursion, a train ride to the base camp of Mount Everest, the fastest way to reach the destination as this ride takes a shortcut through the fabled Forbidden Mountain. Forbidden Mountain is a local legend, having been said to be protected by the creature known as the Yeti, a gigantic and fierce protector inside the mountain that violently keeps man from invading the pristine nature of the Himalayas. Corners and doorways of the building are painted red to keep evil spirits and the Yeti away from the town and within Forbidden Mountain. We enter the building, the office area of the travel company. Computers and schedules display the day's trips, the Desks are covered with paperwork and pictures, along with scattered equipment and reference material for the initial preparation of the ride to base camp. After leaving the office, handwritten signs guide us through the village and around a dried riverbed, the base of the Yeti Mandir, an ancient Mandir pagoda honoring the legendary Yeti. Elaborate and intricate carvings cover the pagoda. Statues line the riverbed and tattered camp flags and bells are strung through the area. Visitors are encouraged to ring the bells as they pass underneath them to further ward off spirits and creatures that lurk in Forbidden Mountain. Leaving the shrine, we walk through part of the lush bamboo forest and enjoy the calm and serene nature of the foothills of the Himalayas. The sole sound of birds chirping is routinely interrupted by passing trains carrying fellow explorers to the Everest base camp. We now enter Tashi's Trek and Tongva shop, the mountaineering equipment shop at Himalayan Escapes. Every piece of expedition equipment imaginable lines the walls, shelves, and even ceiling of the shop. Gloves, jackets, lanterns, canteens, picks, chains, shovels, rope, pots, pans, helmets, sleeping rolls, radios, baskets, and even souvenir t-shirts are available to all would-be explorers. Exiting the shop, we now enter Professor Pema Dorje's Yeti Museum, a museum dedicated to the history and archaeology of the Yeti and its ancestors from all around the world. Artifacts, photos, and research documents adorn the walls. In the center of the room are glass cases displaying relics and cultural totems that can be viewed as we pass by. The main display in the corner of the museum is impossible to miss. It's the remnants of what has become known as the Lost Expedition, an expedition that set out towards Everest in 1982, the first expedition to try to pass through Forbidden Mountain. The expedition was lost, rumored to have encountered the Yeti. All that remains are the ravaged remnants of their base camp recovered just a few years ago. From the museum, we enter the train loading platform. An old steam train pulls up to the deck. The train once carried tea leaves down from the mountains to the village, but now has been refurbished to carry visitors to the Everest base camp. The train departs the platform. The trip begins with a calm but quick ride through the foothill forest of the Himalayas. Banking turns through the lush greenery, leading up to a climb through an ancient temple dedicated to the legend of the Yeti. The temple is decorated with artifacts to the creature and features a large mural of the legend overhead as the train leaves the temple. The climb into the mountain range continues. At its apex, you begin your journey through Forbidden Mountain, banking left into the first shortcut at the Cave of the Mountain. You start your climb again. Suddenly, trouble. The tracks ahead are twisted and broken, bent straight up into the air. Pieces of the track lay scattered, and giant footprints are clearly seen in the snow-covered mountaintop. The train stops. There's a distant roar echoing from inside Forbidden Mountain. The train reverses, escaping backwards through a second shortcut through Forbidden Mountain. The track spirals upward, speeding the train away. A light up ahead promises an escape. The train stops to begin its passage to safety. A shadow appears in the light. A beast of a creature jumps onto the tracks, tearing it apart with its bare hands. Train's escape path, the creature swings out of view to head the train off before it escapes. It becomes a race. The train accelerates, twisting and turning around and through Forbidden Mountain. One last shortcut through the Intrepid Mountain stands between the train passengers and safety. The train barrels through the mountain. Inside, the Yeti stands posed over the track, violently swinging and howling at the train, narrowly missing it. The train barely makes it through the shortcut and out of Forbidden Mountain as it slows down and returns to the safety of the train platform back at Himalayan Escapes and the village of Sirkazong. All right, now that we have a clearer picture of the ride, what all exactly is going on in Expedition Everest? In fact, where did all this start? Well, to tell that story, we have to really kind of go back to the first few years of Animal Kingdom, right when the park had opened. Animal Kingdom quickly developed that dreaded reputation of being just a half day park, meaning it was somewhere that you went, you did your thing for half the day, then you left and went somewhere else to spend your money. This was the same reputation that they had fought with when they first opened MGM Studios as well. Well, oddly enough, for Animal Kingdom, though, when it opened, it did have a featured marquee attraction up and running. The Kilimanjaro Safari Tour had opened with the park when the park opened on April 22nd in 1998. And with just a few kinks to be worked out, it became pretty popular right away, but still not popular enough to keep guests coming to the park or even keeping them there for the whole day. So Disney needed a second marquee ride for Animal Kingdom. They needed something that was going to draw more people to the park, and they also needed this attraction to be something that was going to get visitors to want to do again and again and again. So to get that second marquee crowd-drawing ride to Animal Kingdom, they turned to the lead designer of Animal Kingdom itself, Joe Rohde. Now, this need for a second showcase ride gave Rohde the opportunity to add two things that were currently missing to Animal Kingdom, at least at the time. One was a thrill-a-minute ride, a grand-scale attraction that would hook you the second you stepped into its new area. And second, Rohde was able to bring a mythical creature and finally add a long-lost element to the original idea of the Beastly Kingdom part of Animal Kingdom that never, until this point, had come along. If you don't know this story, when Animal Kingdom was first developed and designed, there was going to be a section called Beastly Kingdom that was going to feature mythical, magical-type creatures. In fact, if you go back and look at the early logo designs for the park, you'll notice that there's a dragon. I think it's dead center of all the shadow silhouettes of the animals. That was part of the representation of the Beastly Kingdom part of the park. Those ideas were scrapped as Animal Kingdom was being built and were never picked up again until now, or at least in this case, in part. So this attraction was now going to be larger than life, and it was going to be born from something that was not found anywhere on Earth. With this idea in mind, Joe Rohde and his team traveled to Nepal in South Asia to get firsthand inspiration, stories, and some insights of not only Mount Everest, but to get some, as it were, insider information, or maybe origin information might be a better term, of the legendary Yeti that is associated with the mountains, the Himalayas specifically. So after traveling to Nepal and bringing back hundreds of pictures and having heard dozens of local stories about the Yeti, a rough plan for this attraction started right away. Both the Imagineers and Walt Disney World wanted this attraction up and running pretty much, not even pretty much, literally as fast as possible. To speed things up, the project team for Everest did something new in this phase of the project, meaning the design phase. They used computer-aided design for much of the planning. Now, in 2014, that sounds like a pretty obvious step. Keep in mind that everything that's ever been done on a computer, no matter what it is, has always been done first somewhere. And for the Imagineers at Disney World, at least for the Animal Kingdom team, this was the first time they had used computers to help do a majority of the designing and planning of an attraction. So the first order of business for this design phase of the attraction was to create this entirely new area for the park. And the focal point of this area was going to be Disney World's newest mountain range. This new mountain range had gone through 24 clay sculpture designs before coming up with the perfect look of the real and majestic Mount Everest alongside the fictitious and ominous-looking Forbidden Mountain. But once this sculpt was completed, it was scanned and a 3D model was put into the computer. And then that's when things really started to move along in the design phase of this project. Working with this 3D scan and the computers gave the ride designers and Imagineers all levels of freedom to try all kinds of different things and get immediate results returned. They knew very quickly what wouldn't work, and just as quick, and more importantly, what would work, including how to add a new Imagineering technological achievement to the ride, which would be a 20-foot-tall, fully animated audio animatronic Yeti. Without even having broken ground for the new area of the park for this attraction, the ride was completely designed. Using the computer for this part of the planning process took what had traditionally taken an average of 3 to 4 years to hammer out for an attraction this size down to only 18 months, half the time or even less than half compared to some of the attractions they had done in the past. With this pretty significant improvement in the mega attraction design process, Disney pushed that innovation envelope just a little further. The project team found an opportunity to extend this technology to the building process as well. Having the entire ride completed in the computer, the Imagineers were able to start disassembling and reassembling all the attraction, including the Yeti, the mountain range itself, the ride. They could do this all virtually and hammer out a plan without the typical trial and error problems during the construction process and prevent a lot of unexpected delays and issues. The innovations into the way attractions were being built, at least this one, weren't limited to just using the computer. The way this mountain range was being built actually afforded a pretty ingenious solution to a problem they were having with an artistic side of this attraction. The mountain range was to be handcrafted and painted by a team, by a large team of artists, and the entire facade was a forced perspective to give the illusion of the entire mountain range being much larger than it actually was to the naked eye. This needed to constantly be checked from the ground to make sure everything looked right. Now, setting up traditional scaffolding was going to cover about 80% of the mountain range from the view on the ground. The solution that was thought of to eliminate this issue was to make further use of that steel support structure that was already being put in place to hold up the entire mountain range. The support structure was going to be a block grid made of steel I-beams. The idea to extend the horizontal running I-beams out an extra 5 feet outside of the surface of the mountain range would allow workers to place support planks where they needed, when they needed it, along the mountain, really clearing up the visible area of the whole facade from the ground. In total, there were 2,000 5-foot-long extensions made for workers to utilize in this now self-supporting scaffolding structure. I want to interject just a personal note here real quick. Finding this piece of information answered a question I had for a long time, or at least had thought of a long time ago. I had seen Everest being built over time, and I certainly saw this phase. I had thought it looked like there were things sticking out of the side of the mountain, but logically, I couldn't figure out what it was or why that would be. So I thought that couldn't be what I was seeing. I wasn't close enough to actually see what it was, and I never got what I thought was the answer. Well, now having found this in the research, apparently that was the answer. I did indeed see things sticking out of the side of the mountain. So for me, that's a little bit of closure on something that I never quite figured out all those years ago. So, all right, now back to Everest. Apart from the self-supporting scaffolding solution that these I-beam extensions had provided, there was yet another significant idea thought of to help to utilize these extensions in the construction process. The surface of the mountain range was being built out of 38 miles worth of bent 3/8-inch rebar, and rather than making entire mountain-sized panels to hoist up and install, the Imagineers created something called the chip method. Square sections of the mountain range surface were created individually and specifically to attach to four of these I-beam extensions by their four corners. Each of these chips, as they were called, they measured about 6 feet by 6 feet, which were much more manageable and faster to produce than the traditional large-scale sections that they had done in the past. Again, using the computer, the exact dimensions and size of each of these chips were designed and laid out, and in total, 3,000 of them were fabricated to cover the face of the mountain range, each with a specific installation location in what could possibly be called the world's largest jigsaw puzzle. Now, with the design completed, the plan in place, and these new innovations in building worked out, it was time to actually start building the Everest attraction. The first and kind of unremarkable thing to happen was the ground was cleared and the foundations created. But after that, the more impressive thing started to happen when 5,000 tons of structural steel rolled in to start creating the support structure for the mountain range. So Disney World's latest mountain range started to take shape, albeit in steel I-beam form and kind of abstract at this point. But going off the plans made from the computer models, once the mountain range, or at least the support structure for the mountain range, hit a certain point, work began on the construction of the foundation for the animatronic Yeti, as well as the support structures for the actual roller coaster itself. Using these plans they had laid out in the computer really tightened up the construction time and efficiency altogether. All these things could go on pretty much simultaneously and get the job done a lot quicker than traditional methods had allowed up to this point. Now, the roller coaster itself, despite whatever theming or story you build around it, is what was going to draw people to this ride, so it had to be good. And Disney went to a trusted partner for this, the coaster manufacturer Vekoma in the Netherlands. Vekoma had delivered on big roller coasters for Disney in the past. They built the Barnstormer, the Gadget Go Coaster at Disneyland Tokyo, Space Mountain Mission 2 in Disneyland Paris, and not too far from Animal Kingdom, the Rockin' Roller Coaster at Disney Hollywood Studios. The plans for the coaster were given to Vekoma, and the actual ride element of this ride started, along with building a new anti-rollback system crucial for selling this attraction story to the riders. We'll get more to that soon. That explanation of that will make a little more sense when told with a few other ride elements that we're coming to shortly. So construction is started in Florida. Engineering and ride building is underway in the Netherlands. There's one more big feature being worked on, and that is being worked on in California, and that is the Yeti herself. I'm going to break in here with another personal note real quick. I had just said the Yeti herself, and that is something I'm still getting used to, because when I look at the Yeti, my mind either sees her as a male, or maybe not even gender specific. While researching this episode, I read and heard the ride creator Joe Rohde refer to the Yeti as her and she more than once. So with Joe being the creature's creator, I'm going to try to respect his creative decision and refer to the Yeti as female as best I can. Okay, with that out of the way, let's get back once again to Everest. Now, I said earlier in this episode that designing the Yeti was going to be a unique opportunity. The Imagineers had this chance to create a creature that doesn't actually exist, yet make it look like it could be found somewhere in the world, and more specifically, look like it would fit in the surroundings that they were going to put her in, the caves of the Himalaya Mountains. They could probably have easier, and this is really just me speculating here, have created a Disney-esque animated type creature, and it still would probably have much of the same impact on the ride. But this was a chance to be uniquely creative. To help create this realistic creature, Disney Imagineers brought in a biologist named Stuart Samita as a consultant. With Samita's guidance, they started with a base primate, then started to evolve in a sense, at least with paper and pencil, to fit the environment and add some of the elements found in Tibetan art of the Yeti legend. It was also going to have to fit the story of the attraction, so it was going to have to be big, it had to look angry, and by all appearances look to be incredibly strong. All in all, this design process might have been the easiest part, because once it was done, it still had to be built. This part of the ride was set to be a revolutionary accomplishment in audio animatronics. It was going to be the biggest, heaviest and fastest moving large-scale creature that Disney had ever built. To quote Joe Rohde himself, "There's nothing this big that moves this fast." And ironically, take the last two words off that quote and you can better describe the Yeti today. But we're going to get more into that later. The Yeti stands 22 feet tall, which is almost the height of an average two-story house. And it weighs 20,000 pounds, or put another way, 10 tons. It's built with 19 actuators that give movement to her arm, wrist, fingers, elbow, shoulders, hip, head, neck, jaw, and spine. With its sheer size and weight, the Yeti isn't mounted like traditional animatronics found on most Disney attractions. For the most part, the animatronics are mounted by their legs and feet. For the 10-ton two-story Yeti, she's mounted on her back, closer to her center of gravity. She's mounted to a horizontal and vertical sliding system, which gives movement to the entire creature. It lets her move back and forth a full 5 feet and up and down 18 inches, or a foot and a half. All of the movements are created by air pressure. There's a 60-gallon pump capable of creating 4,000 gallons per minute of air pressure that feeds 8 15-gallon holding tanks that are all used to move specific parts of the Yeti. When the Yeti's animation cycle is complete, the entire system can be recharged in 20 seconds, which is just enough time for the next passing train when the ride is running at full capacity. An interesting side note to the amount of air pressure that's used to animate the Yeti, if all 19 actuators were released at once, the amount of air thrust that would produce would be greater than a 747's engine. The skin that covers the massive frame of the creature is 1,000 square feet in total, and it's held on by 1,000 snaps and 250 zippers. With this new evolution, in a sense, of animatronics, one traditional piece of classic and proven technology was still used to bring the Yeti to life. The same control board that was first developed in the 1960s was used by animators to program the movements of the Yeti. This was the same method used to control and animate the very first Disney audio animatronic creatures. But adapting it to a more modern age, the animations and programming were recorded by a computer and then smoothed out and tweaked just a bit. But mostly this was done on this original control board. Now with the Yeti completed in California, it was time to crate her up and send her on her way to Orlando, where the mountain range was starting to take shape and the fictional village of Circa Zong started to come together. At this point in the construction phase, tracks were started to be seen intertwined within the steel structure and pieces of the mountain forming around that. The ride was really starting to take shape at this point. I've talked a lot about the Yeti so far, but the coaster for this attraction is really no slouch itself, despite some of the criticisms I've heard and read about it. I've heard Everest criticized as not being fast enough. Its lack of inversions makes some argue that it's not really a thrill ride, that it's more of a family ride. I'm not going to argue one way or the other about this outside of giving my personal opinion, but I am going to point out some of the engineering of this ride that tends to go largely unnoticed. And in reality, that's what makes these things great about this ride, is that you don't notice them. They happen so seamlessly that they might actually work to undersell the ride in a sense. But once you know they're there, you might look at the attraction a little differently. I'm actually going to start out by talking about something you probably do notice, and that is the chain pulls on the hill lifts. There's actually two of them. They're very recognizable. They're not hidden. And if you're a roller coaster fanatic, or at least a fan, you've certainly recognized what they are and what they do. But what you might not have noticed is that there's something that traditionally accompanies the sight of the pull chain that's missing on Everest. And that is the classic anti-rollback clacking sound that sounds like this. You don't hear this because this coaster features a new, or at least what was new at the time, anti-rollback mechanism. This is what I mentioned early in the episode when I was talking about the coaster manufacturer Vekoma. Vekoma had built this new anti-rollback system for this ride. The reason they had to do this was because of the ride's story. According to the story, you're riding a train to Everest through Forbidden Mountain. That recognizable clacking could ruin that story element. This is probably a case of you don't notice that it's not there, but it would almost certainly stand out to you if it was. To eliminate this sound, Disney designed a magnetic anti-rollback system. This completely removed the mechanics typically used for an anti-rollback system and replaced them with linear electromagnets. There's a fin under the trains that passes between magnetic stopping points. If the train were to slip back, the magnetic points would hold onto that fin and keep the train from running back down the tracks. The concept pretty much works almost exactly like a traditional anti-rollback system, but completely silently. Another thing you can't help but notice in the attraction is that you go backwards on the ride, and you may or may not have noticed that it is a completely different set of tracks you're going down when this happens. Chances are you probably guessed that, but what you don't see is the switching of the tracks that actually makes this happen. Again, Disney wanting to eliminate that obvious clues that something was going to happen on the ride created a new track switching system. This track switching system on Everest is a 180-degree rotating system. The track that leads you to the switch point is on one side, and the track that leads you to the backwards portion of the ride is on the other. While you're stopped at the top of the mountain, at the portion of the track that's destroyed by the Yeti and bent up into the air, all the switching takes place behind you, out of sight. The entire switchover takes 6 seconds. That might not sound fast, but this rail section weighs over 200,000 pounds or 100 tons. It has to register that it's safe to proceed, unlock, spin 180 degrees, lock again, and then give the all clear signal all in 6 seconds. Again, something that you don't think about when it's done out of sight. But if you were to see the traditional sliding track system ahead of you as you approach that stop, you'll know to expect that something is going to happen in this ride when the train starts again. So now at this point of the history of the creation of Everest, the surface of the mountain is now built. The chips for the mountain range were installed and the entire structure has now been sculpted with 20 million pounds of concrete. When the cap of Forbidden Mountain is placed on the attraction, Expedition Everest became the highest mountain range in Walt Disney World. It also became the fifth mountain range in Disney World. Now, as a little bit of a trivia segment here, I am going to list all five. So you can play along if you need a moment to get to your iPod or smartphone or other MP3 player to hit pause to guess before I give the answers. I'm going to ramble on and I've run out of things to say, so I'm going to have to list them now. So here we go. The five mountains of Walt Disney World are Expedition Everest, of course, Big Thunder Mountain, Space Mountain, Splash Mountain, and the fifth and the one I always forget about, Mount Gushmore at Blizzard Beach. That is, of course, as of this recording. If Disney decides to build the Triple Horn Mountains of Alderaan in the new Star Wars area, that's obviously not going to appear on my list. The Expedition Everest range also has the highest mountain peak at 199 feet. And that 199 is not an accidental number. The Federal Aviation Authority requires structures 200 feet or taller to have a red flashing light at its peak. To avoid that, it was purposely designed to be only 199 feet tall. So now at this point in the construction process, to get everything complete, there are now crews of 500 workers per day starting to flow into the Everest area. Sculptors completed the concrete surface, and then painters were brought in to paint the mountain range, which took 2,000 gallons of paint to do. This is where being able to see a lot of the mountain from the ground really became necessary. The painting being done to the mountain range created a large majority of the forced perspective illusion, particularly in the artificial shadows they were placing throughout the mountain range. Now, inside the mountain, there's a completely different perspective. It's hollow, and inside is a massive grid of red steel I-beams supporting the mountain range, and intertwined throughout that are the black steel support structures for the roller coaster. Now, these steel supports that hold up the roller coaster can move 6 inches in any direction when the ride is actually moving. So everything inside this structure was meticulously placed as to not actually make contact when these support structures did move. Again, as brought up early on and quite a few times in this episode, all planned out and executed by the aid of the computer design early on in the design of this attraction. And amongst all of this seemingly organized chaos was the massive structure of the Yeti. And this, too, was assembled in a specific sequence to, one, fit properly amongst everything, and two, to get the project up and running as quick as possible. So now going back to the painting of the mountain range, or actually getting to the end of the painting, once this process was done, all that self-supporting scaffolding that we talked about, that wasn't needed anymore. So the planks were all removed and those I-beam extensions were cut off. Now, if you remember, when I first brought up these I-beams, I said that there was 2,000 of these thick, solid steel extensions. Cutting them off one by one took a full 3 months to complete. But once they were cut away, the areas they were cut from were skimmed over with cement and then paint added to blend in with that section of the mountain. Essentially, this entire self-supporting scaffolding structure just disappeared. So now that the mountain is covered and all the ride tracks are in place and this scaffolding has vanished, it was time to get the train on the tracks and to start testing things out. And the train on this ride was going to resemble just that, a train, specifically a repurposed steam train. To sell the idea of this part of the story, there was one thing that was going to be able to do that best, and that was to add steam to the train somehow. Now, to get this train going its fastest, it had to be light, and that isn't limited to this ride. That goes across the board for all roller coasters. So adding some sort of onboard effect to create the steam would add weight to the vehicle that really didn't need to be there for the ride to run its best. it would have been an unnecessary weight addition that really served no purpose other than this visual effect. But still, the steam engine would really sell the story, which was the big picture and important to Disney on this ride. So the Imagineers did come up with a solution for it, and if you keep your eyes open and know what to look for, you can actually see it from the loading dock of the ride. The next time you ride Everest, if you wait in line for one of the back rows of the train, take a good look down at the track, specifically where the back of the train is going to stop. You'll see two nozzles pointing straight up in the air from the center of the track. These nozzles push high-pressure steam from under and into the rear of the train, giving the illusion that the train itself is producing steam when it stops and departs. In reality, all of this is taking place completely outside of the train and is essentially really just passing through the facade of the rear engine of this train. There are sound effects that are hard to miss, namely the Yeti roars and the cold, ominous winds at the top of the mountain where the train stops. And this is produced by a 200-speaker sound system that's wired throughout the ride. The sound system kicks in immediately when you leave the dock, including the bird chirping you hear when you go through the wooded area of the foothills, all the way to the very last Yeti roar you hear as you come out of the last cave and return to the station. The last element added to the ride that I have noted is probably the most underappreciated, it certainly has been by me, and that is the indigenous plants and trees brought into the outside queuing area and the foothills portion of the train ride that were added to the park. I never knew that until doing this research, and I may have to take a closer look at exactly what that is the next time I wait in line. Now, I've talked a good bit about the colossal animatronic Yeti and even described it in the ride walkthrough. And if you've been on this ride anytime in the past 5 years, you're probably thinking, hey, stupid, the Yeti doesn't do anything. It just stands there. And you're right. But it didn't always just stand there. It did move at one point. It moved a lot. And I've been lucky enough to see it move several times prior to March 2009. That's when it stopped moving. It's actually better to say that's when it was turned off. It can still run. There's nothing really wrong with the mechanics of the Yeti. If they decided to run it, though, it would be a pretty dangerous thing to do. And here's why. In 2009, Disney discovered the foundation of the Yeti portion of the attraction was cracked, and cracked severely. So much to the point that if the Yeti continued to operate, there was the real risk of the Yeti animatronic breaking free from the foundation and crashing down on the tracks. To prevent this, the Yeti was placed in B mode permanently. Its B mode keeps the Yeti in a static pose and strobe lights flicker as the train passes to mimic movement. It's an illusion that might fool you once, but that's about it. So, what exactly caused this crack? Well, there's been no official explanation from Disney about what or how this happened, at least none that I could find. But there is a pretty plausible theory formed around what is known that I've read that might explain what happened. This theory pretty much boils down to, in this quick-paced building process, weight and pressure was added to the Yeti's foundation before it had entirely cured properly. By all appearances, everything looked fine when the attraction was complete. But once the ride began operating, the repeated power, pressure, and vibration of the ride started to weaken the foundation and it cracked. Now, all of this, of course, is speculation, but regardless, the fact remains that the foundation is indeed cracked. So the obvious question to follow that up is, why hasn't it been fixed in over 5 years? Well, that might not be as easy as it sounds. Almost ironically, that meticulous construction process that made the building of this attraction so quick and efficient is what's preventing quick and efficient repairs. Large sections of the coaster track and significant portions of the mountain range support structure would have to be dismantled to access the problem area. And that's assuming it could be fixed and not need to be replaced completely. Replacement looks at even more of this type of work to get it done. Completely taking cost out of the equation, time is a huge issue. At best, and being extremely conservative, this process would bring down one of Animal Kingdom's major attractions for at least 6 months, probably closer to an entire year. But despite all this, Joe Rohde has gone on record at the 2013 D23 Expo saying, and I quote, "I will fix the Yeti." Shortly after this quote made the rounds of theme park news and blog sites, strong rumors that a lighter, part marionette, part animatronic version of the Yeti was currently being built by Garner Holt Productions, Inc., but those rumors were eventually proven to be just rumors. Even without the Yeti fully working, there's still some respectable stats for this ride. It has a top forward speed of 50 miles per hour and a top backward speed of 40. The forward G-forces top out at 2.2 and the top backwards G-forces reach 3. The highest hill is 120 feet tall and the longest forward drop is 80 feet long. The trains carry 34 passengers every 60 seconds, and when all four trains are running, the attraction can put 1,850 riders through per hour. You do, of course, exit through the gift shop, aptly named the Expedition Everest Gift Shop, and for further shopping pleasure, there is the Yak and Yeti shop nearby as well. One last ride detail I'd like to point out is when you step out onto the train platform, there's a community announcement board at one end of that area. Look for a small handwritten post-it note near the bottom of the board that reads, "Lost one yak, if found, called Bob." That is my wife's favorite little detail, and she always looks for it every time we ride Everest. The budget for the entire attraction was a reported $100 million, and with the ride taking about 4 minutes to run, that is $25 million per minute experience investment. I personally really enjoy this ride. I've been lucky enough to ride it when the Yeti fully worked, and I've been on it several times since the Yeti has been put in its perpetual B mode. It's definitely my favorite attraction at Animal Kingdom. I'm not sure where it ranks for me overall for Disney World. I thought it might be in my top five, but when I started to just casually put together a top five list just starting in Disney Hollywood Studios, Rock and Roller Coaster, Tower of Terror, and Star Tours already made the list, and that was only in one park. So I'm not sure if I actually put that top five Disney World list together that Everest would make that cut. I remember when I first heard this attraction was coming, it was on the recording on the tram that took us back through the parking lot as you left the park. And I remember that description made me think that this was going to be kind of a modern updated version 2 of the Matterhorn from Disneyland. And I guess you could make the case that it kind of is, but I mean, story-wise, it certainly wasn't. I remember seeing the opening day ceremonies on a local news morning show. I know we wouldn't have gone on the ride within the first couple months it opened, and we probably waited for the whole summer tourist season to end before we actually first rode Everest. So I don't have the exact date of when I went, but I'm going to say it was probably the following fall of its April opening. If you're wondering if there's any particular or even personal reason why I've selected this as my subject matter for the second episode of this podcast series, no, there is. If you follow Neozaz or listen to any of the other Neozaz series I'm on, you probably know that I enjoy running and participate in a lot of distance races. And if you didn't know that, well, there you go. Now, thanks to my sister having caught the running bug and the two of us having run the Disney Princess Half Marathon together, a race I was waiting until I had one of the women in my life to run with before I participated in, I've now participated in every major race and every Run Disney Weekend event at Disney World, and I'll be chasing my second Coast to Coast Marathon Challenge medal at Disneyland this November. But the one that started my sub-obsession with Run Disney events and to this day is still my absolute, hands-down, all-time favorite Run Disney event and the only Run Disney event I've repeated every year since I started running is the Expedition Everest Challenge. Now, it's not the longest race of the year, and not by a long shot, but it is the most unique, and for my money, it is the most fun event all year. It's a two-part event. The first is a 5K with some small obstacles, nothing on the level of a Tough Mudder or Warrior Dash, just something a little different than your average 5K. Then there's a second part. It's the part they call the scavenger hunt, but it's more of a series of brain teaser puzzles, I think. When you're done with the 5K, you're handed a card with a puzzle on it and the station that you need to move on to next. When you reach that station, you tell the attendant the answer, and when you give them the correct answer, you're handed a second puzzle. There's five puzzles in all, and then all these puzzles then get you a final answer that you relay to one of the race monitors to get to the finish line. To give an example to better explain, the final answer this year was a number. So as you're running to the finish line, there's about two dozen course monitors, and you're holding up the number with your fingers, and they wave you through, and then you can sprint and end the race. After that, you can enjoy about half of the Animal Kingdom park until 4 in the morning. The dinosaur ride is open, a few of the restaurants and food carts are open, and of course, Expedition Everest is open. This is the one time a year I get to ride Everest at night, and it's a whole new experience. It's actually my favorite way to ride this attraction. I've run this race for the past 4 years. The first 3 years I ran as a solo participant, but this past May I ran it with my wife Christy as a partner, and that actually made this even more fun. This is the best run Disney race event, in my opinion. If you've ever thought about running a run Disney event at Disney World, but you didn't want to do a half marathon or the full marathon distance, or even the 10Ks, which are adding more and more of every year, I highly recommend this one. It's great. They have great finisher medals. It's the most unique race, and it is the one, if I had to pick one run Disney event to run every year, it's not even a question in my mind. It will always be Expedition Everest Challenge. For this year's race, I brought along a portable recorder and recorded some parts of the race. Now, unfortunately, it did rain a lot that night, but that didn't dampen our spirits at all, and it didn't seem to dampen the spirits of anyone else at that race either. But it did force me to keep the recorder undercover and dry as possible, so not to ruin it. So I didn't get to record every detail I wanted of the race, but I still got, I think, enough to give a good sense of what the event's like. So here's a bit of a bonus segment. Here is some of Team Neozaz at the 2014 Expedition Everest Challenge.
All right, Matt, Neozaz.com. Team Neozaz is here at the 2014 Everest Challenge. Little rainy, little wet, but still gonna have fun. This is my fourth race. This is your, Christy's with me, my teammate, my very first teammate, and your first race. How you feeling?
Feeling pumped now that it's stopped raining.
All right, you excited about this race? You heard about it from me for the past 3 years. You ready to use your brain as much as your legs?
I'm a brain that both hold out.
You said the first obstacle?
Yes.
A lot better than the last time you did an obstacle course race, right?
Yes, I did not get hurt or start bleeding.
So we're almost a mile done. Woo-hoo. Two to go, none of the puzzle.
Yeah, I'm fine.
Two obstacles down, first the hay bales and the tires. How you feeling?
Feeling good.
We got like a 0.2 miles to go, that's it.
That is freaking awesome.
I'll stop bothering you now.
Okay.
Okay, blue one. Let's go.
Use another item you've been given for the race and know that we need you to flag the right color.
Okay, so that's something to do with our bib.
Okay, so
I can't read and walk at the same time with you.
Okay, the yellow is focused.
We don't have a yellow.
Then that's what we need this, don't we?
Huh?
Passion, a compelling emotion that won't fail us even though when this going gets tough.
It's got to be focused. There's no yellow. That's the answer.
Okay.
Yeah, I think it's that easy.
Okay. Go to Palm Courtyard, Palms. Okay. So we circle it?
Well, we'll tell them when we get there.
Oh, okay.
The pen is for the, when we have to figure out stuff.
Ooh, it's got a flashlight and a pen. Okay.
Thanks. All right. Things that are hidden in the text next to your color flag, you can select clue number one. Okay, but what are they? These words give you a hint. Prime, whole, odd.
Wait, what was it? What was our color again? White?
White.
No, it was white or green.
I don't remember.
Green.
All right, well, we're done. We got our medals. You're taking your selfie. So, this is your first Everest Challenge. It's done. We're on our way to the party. We're going to ride the ride one time before we go home. What did you think of the race?
It was very, very fun. I was actually kind of surprised at myself. I didn't really think that I had it in me, especially because the weather's been so crappy and I haven't been able to train and just flat out haven't felt motivated to train. I was really kind of surprised at myself, But and the clues were fun. The scavenger hunt part was fun.
I was a little worried after the first one. We had trouble. We stumbled on the first one bad, but after that, I think we got them pretty quick. But I was a little worried at first.
Me too. But then when I saw the one where it was putting the letters in there, I was like, I got this. Wheel of Fortune.
Yeah. So, well, well, I don't know what else really to say other than we're going to go get something to eat, get a beer, ride a ride, and call it a night.
That sounds like an excellent plan.
All right, well.
Let's do this again next year.
Until next year, this was Everest 2014.
Woo!
So, that is all I have to share this time around about Expedition Everest, both the ride and the race challenge. If you have any memories of this ride, or the Expedition Everest challenge for that matter, please share it on our Facebook page at facebook.com/neozazpodcast, or you can send me an email at attractionobsession@neozaz.com. That will wrap it up for this episode of Attraction Obsession. I hope you've enjoyed it. Join me next time when we venture out of Orlando and head all the way to the other side of the U.S. chasing down my white whale of rides, Six Flags Magic Mountain Superman Escape from Krypton. For more on that story, make sure to subscribe on iTunes and download the next episode of Attraction Obsession. I'll see you there. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to Attraction Obsession. Attraction Obsession is a NeoZazz.com production and part of the NeoZazz.com podcast network. For more great podcast and original entertainment, please visit NeoZazz.com. For all the latest news and information for Attraction Obsession and NeoZazz.com, follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/NeoZazzPodcasts.
We're at the 2014 Everest. Little rainy, little chilly. I got a cold. I'm not going to capture the magic of 2012 tonight, so this is not my race to win. How are you feeling tonight?
I'm feeling pumped up, and I wish it wasn't raining.
I just remember the words of Mark Allen when I ran up to him on his very last Ironman, and he said, "Get away from me, I don't know you." So, that was, I'll be echoing in my head during tonight's race.